Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of our two-part conversation with Bill Langfan and Mark Langfan, two prominent figures in the American Jewish community and leaders in American Zionism. Again, gentlemen, welcome. Mark, just again, give us a before and after, if you would, in terms of the topography of the state of Israel and why the Six-Day War made such a difference to its security.
Well, the key is you had the north and the south threats from Syria and Egypt, but you had the middle threat, which was from Jordan, which at that time controlled the mountains of Judea and the mountains of Samaria, which rise right to the west of Israel's heartland, where 70% of her population is. So what happens was Israel dealt a preemptive blow to Syria and Egypt, and Egypt, in an attempt to lure King Hussein into the war, told everybody that they were winning and destroyed Israel. So despite the fact that Israel had expressly sent a message through the UN to King Hussein that Israel was not intending to attack the West Bank, King Hussein effectively started launching artillery strikes against Israel's very population centers. Just imagine, if you will, the concentration of New York City or similar, or Brooklyn, and someone firing artillery shells into Brooklyn.
We would not stand for it, that's for sure.
A fire a simple artillery shell from a mountain right into the valley, which is, again, the heartland of Israel.
Which speaks to the importance, again, of this high ground. And so in addition to the West Bank and the mountains there, you also had the Golan Heights, of course. Talk, Mark, if you would, about the physical barriers that these created to enemy action once they were in Israeli hands, and set the stage for the conversation I want to have about the idea of relinquishing them.
Exactly. The key part to the mountains is not just that they're mountains, but the purpose of the mountains for Israel's security gets back to what we talked about earlier, which is the standing army versus the reserve army. Israel needs those mountains in order to have time for Israel to have a call up of its reserves in order to scale up its order of battle to effectively fight these huge standing armies of the Arabs and the Muslims. So if Israel were to, God forbid, relinquish those territories today, you would have a situation where enemies like Hamas or Hezbollah could fire simple Katyushas into Israel's population centers and thereby cause a huge failure of Israel's ability to mobilize.
You know, to say nothing of incredible loss of life among the civilian population. And Bill Langfan, you've heard these ideas for a long time, that if only Israel will relinquish the territories that it obtained, that it, well, liberated, in my way of thinking, restored to Israelis' control, that was the most important legacy of the Six-Day War, that there will be peace with the Palestinians, or peace more generally with the Arab world. I know you've been deeply skeptical of this based on the hard experience of, World War II and all of the wars that Israel has been subjected to by its enemies. Talk a little bit about this idea of land for peace, Bill, if you would.
Land for peace was the underpinning, supposedly, of Oslo. Israel was to convey control of segments on a slow basis to see whether or not the Palestinian leadership was advancing in the proper fashion. And it turned out that Israel did relinquish a very significant segment of land, and the Palestinian leadership, particularly under Arafat, had promised to have the Palestinian National Council annul the clauses in their charter calling for Israel's destruction. And they created a series of steps of deception, making believe that they were in the process of changing the charter and annulling the onerous clauses of destruction of Israel. And believe it or not, they were able to deceive our then President Clinton and Netanyahu into thinking they actually did change the charter. To this day, not one word of the charter has ever been changed, and we're living today under three different formal documents by Hamas, the PLO, and Fatah, all calling for the destruction of Israel.
Yeah. So their objectives remain the same. Their ability, and this includes, of course, the people that we are told, like Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority, Fatah, the PLO, the so-called partner for peace, that if only Israel will relinquish the high ground of the West Bank, they're encouraged, of course, to give back the Golan to Syria as well, we'll see these parties if not renounce, at least not act on their commitment to destroy the state of Israel. And Mark, let me just conclude with you. Should those lands be turned back to hostile powers, what would be the prospect for Israel's security, perhaps even its survival?
Well, in my view, the prospect is catastrophic for Israel's survival. However, what I want all your listeners to understand is this is not a question about Jewish survival. This is a question about survival of the Western world and of the United States itself. And all anyone has to do is look at a simple map on my website where you see the Middle East and you see Greece that has only 11 million Christians in Greece, and that this country is sworn to defend under NATO. And you rapidly come to a conclusion just by adding up the populations that there are 370 million Muslims to the southeast, and then you have 11 million Christians in Greece to the northwest. And the only non-Muslim country between those 370 million Muslims and the 11 million Christians of Greece that we're sworn to defend under NATO is the state of Israel. And if God forbid something happened to Israel, you wouldn't have the soft jihad today where they're bringing suitcases. You'd have a hard jihad, where they would be bringing Kalashnikovs against Greece.
There's so much more to talk about than we've got time to do today, but I want to thank you both, Bill Langfan and Mark Langfan, for your insights into this incredibly important moment in history, the anniversary of the Six-Day War, and the lessons that we should learn from what preceded it and what has flowed from it. I thank you for your leadership, both of you, in helping the rest of us make sense of this, and I pray that you will keep up your good work and come back to us in the near future, and that the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Dr. Luis Fleischman, a man we have turned to for a long time on matters involving our hemisphere and the U.S. security interests that are affected by what's happening in important parts of it. He is a senior advisor to the Mencus Hemispheric Security Project at the Center for Security Policy, where he edits its The Americas report. He is also an adjunct professor of political science and sociology at Wilkes Honor College at Florida Atlantic University. You can also read Luis Fleischmann's latest book, a very important one, entitled Latin America in the Post-Chavez Age, The Security Threat to the United States. Dr. Fleischmann, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
A pleasure to be here, Frank.
Well, unfortunately, the pleasure is limited by one of the things that we have to discuss, which is the seemingly continuing unraveling of Venezuela. As I mentioned, your book focused on its previous dictator, who did much to contribute to its present condition, made worse, of course, by his successor, Nicolas Maduro. Give us the latest, Luis, if you would, please, on how the Venezuelan people are coping with what the government there has inflicted upon them.
Well, I think the most important thing that is happening in Venezuela now is that people have lost fear. The Venezuelan government is seeing an uprising, is trying to change it, is trying to repress the uprising, but it cannot. In other words, the Venezuelan people continue to fight. The situation is turning worse and worse. We are seeing the use of violence being more widespread. We are seeing the situation getting worse and worse. And at the same time, we are seeing an international community that is not doing much. Most recently, the Organization of American States actually postponed a decision on Venezuela because the Caribbean states, who have been enjoying the Venezuelan largesse for many, many, many years, objected to sanctioning or to punishing or to even discussing Venezuela.
Dr. Luis Fleischmann is joining us to discuss what's happening in Venezuela. And you've been describing, Luis, for some time now, a steady unraveling of the economy, which seems almost unbelievable given the immense oil wealth that the country has, at least in the ground. The political system has come off the rails. It's clear that there's now increasing repression, as you say, by the regime. And yet the protests are growing and becoming more, assertive. And yet they are not bringing about real relief, which raises the question, what can the United States government of Donald Trump do to try to shape events there in a way that's both consistent with our own interests, but also the aspirations of the Venezuelan people?
Well, there is no question that the Venezuelan government is taking the model of the Castro regime in Cuba. That means they're going to hold on to power till the very end. They are not going to give up power. They believe that they can hold it the same way that the Cuban regime has done it for the last almost 60 years. I believe that the countries of the Organization of American States do not have the ability to put effective pressure on Venezuela, no matter what they say, no matter what they do. It's only the United States that can bring change in Venezuela. And in my opinion, we need crippling sanctions on Venezuela. And I know there has been an article in Forbes magazine opposing to that because they said the Venezuelan government will fall on its own. The Venezuelan government is not going to fall on its own because the Venezuelan government wants to hold on to power and is resorting to the Russians and is resorting to the Iranians and is resorting to the Cubans. Therefore, what I believe that since we have so much control of CITGO right here, it is important to sanction CITGO and stop buying oil from them, and also sanctioning and freezing the assets of every military officer and every political officer associated with Maduro. They are all involved in drug trafficking. They are all involved in some sort of criminal activity. They all have some sort of connection to Iran and Hezbollah. I don't understand why we are hesitating. Meanwhile, it's interesting, the White House needs to step in. At this point, The State Department is interesting because the Trump administration said that they want to clean up the State Department. But the person who is dealing with Venezuela policy at this point in the State Department is basically an old bureaucrat, Michael Fitzpatrick. And his statements have been basically the legacy of the previous administration, namely, don't make too much noise. No, in my opinion, we need to step in.
Luis Fleischman, you have described a course of action that the president could presumably introduce fairly quickly in terms of cutting off oil purchases from Venezuela and sale of gasoline to Venezuela. One of the arguments, of course, that's being made is that such steps would actually hurt the people of Venezuela. You say that they would be welcoming of them, I guess on the grounds that that would be crippling to what's left of the government's life support. Is that right?
Well, I think so. I mean, of course, the Venezuelan government is going to say that the Americans are starving the Venezuelans, but the Venezuelans are starving now. If there is a method to impose heavy sanctions on the individuals and have only the individuals associated with government being punished and not the entire Venezuelan people, that will be terrific. If there is a formula like this, at this point, I am not an expert as to determine how exactly that can be done. I think if it can be done, it's much better. But obviously, these soft sanctions have not worked. We need to isolate Maduro. We need to basically make the life of these people impossible. We already have the prosecutor, the attorney general in Venezuela, already trying to defend the constitutionality of the country against the abuses of Maduro. So that means we are seeing internal dissent. So we need to encourage internal dissent in the government itself so that Maduro remains absolutely isolated, particularly the military.
Let me ask you quickly about CITGO. One of the issues, of course, is that increasingly it's now controlled by the Russians. There's a lot of talk, as you know, Luis, about Russian interference in our elections. I wonder whether we shouldn't be at least as concerned about the possibility that if the Russians wind up through this sort of fire sale that they've achieved on CITGO's assets in the United States, picking them up for pennies on the dollar from PDVSA in Venezuela, whether we won't likely see Russian interference in our energy sector, which could be even more consequential than what they tried to do to our election.
You are absolutely right. The problem of the Russians is not just that they interfere in our elections or try to interfere in our elections, whatever we find in the end. It's the fact that the Russians are taking advantage of our passivity in our Western hemisphere. The Russians at this point are playing a game. They are trying to expand their sphere of influence. And of course, the Western hemisphere, which has been a natural sphere of influence for the United States since the Monroe Doctrine in 1823, now the Russians have a very serious presence. I mean, they actually have been involved with Venezuela, with Ecuador, not to speak about Cuba, Nicaragua. They are well embedded there. So you're right. Our energy sector is crucial because if they take over CITGO, this is going to be a serious step, but also they are taking our geopolitical assets.
Luis Fleischman, thank you so much for your time today and your expertise. Commend again to all of our listeners the work you do at Mengus Hemispheric Security Program of the Center for Security Policy. Next up, Kevin Freeman takes us inside his economic war room to talk about developments in the Middle East, specifically with respect to Qatar and what it might mean for you. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by our friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our senior fellow specializing in economic warfare, Kevin Freeman. Kevin is the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, and Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. Kevin is the genius behind GlobalEconomicWarfare.com, a terrific website resource. He is also soon to be the star of a new program at the Blaze Network entitled Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin, it's good to have you. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, there's a couple of things that I want to get into, and we won't have time to do justice to any of them, I'm afraid. But just to pick up on something that I was discussing with Luis Fleischman a moment ago, and that is the current thrashing on the latest evidence out of the National Security Agency that Russia actually hacked into some of our balloting systems, or certainly was very hard at it, is calling to mind, to me at least, the larger problem, the much more serious problem in many ways, of their potential ability to interfere with a very important sector of our economy, namely our energy sector. I know you've been concerned about this with respect to this transaction involving Citgo assets from Venezuela to the Russians. Give us a quick sense of how serious this problem is as you see it, Kevin Freeman.
Well, first, if they were hacking into the election, it was with the intention ultimately to impact our energy decisions. Energy is the lifeblood of Russia. Putin has been called out multiple times on interfering with various nations around the world attempts to get energy independent through hydraulic fracking and through technology and shale oil plays to have an entree into one of our most significant sectors, energy, but particularly in refining. That's exactly what he's trying to get at. And so we're opposing him on the one side, don't hack into our elections as we should, while leaving an open door because it just looks like a commercial transaction, and letting him, through Russian interests, purchase and control a lot of our refining capacity.
I think all of us have to be attending closely to what is apparently now going on in the way of a formal investigation by the so-called Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which I hope will recognize that this is a very serious threat to our economy and will oppose this transaction. Kevin, let me turn to, speaking of oil, speaking of countries that are interested in disrupting our energy sector, the nation of Qatar, currently the subject of an intense internecine struggle with other Arab oil states and others in the region over its activities that are causing them problems, but also, needless to say, are causing us problems as well. What do you make of this struggle at the moment? And should we regard Qatar as an ally? We have bases there, of course, and our government has been indicating that it's neutral in all of this. But are they, in fact, friend or foe?
Well, we should hope that Qatar would be an ally, but they've certainly not acted like it. We have direct evidence of their role and involvement in the Arab Spring, which caused enormous problems in the Middle East. We know that they harbor and support the Muslim Brotherhood, which is something we should declare a terror group here in the United States, as many other nations have done. We know that they were involved as a sovereign wealth fund in the 2008 financial crisis, and they were large owners of Barclays, and they were pushing Barclays not to support Lehman Brothers, which triggered all of the financial collapse, and they've historically harbored people that are very anti-American. So we'd like to have them as an ally. They just haven't acted like one.
Talk a bit more about this business, Kevin Freeman, this Sheikh Yusuf Qaradawi and his prominent role in the nation and sovereign wealth fund of Qatar. Also his program on Al Jazeera, a propaganda arm of the Qatari government that's virulently Sharia supremacist, as is Qaradawi. And in particular, some of the forensic work that you have done, documented in your terrific book, Secret Weapon, about the role that Qatar played in taking down the U.S. economy in September 2008. In fact, beginning, as I recall, on September 11th, 2008.
That's right. On September 11th, 2008, the trigger was pulled on a plan that may have been hatched at the Qatari Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is Sharia compliant. And as you know, a Sharia compliant fund has to adhere to certain restrictions and guidelines. But one of those is they have to have a Sharia scholar. And the Sharia scholar is this guy, Qaradawi, who is a Muslim Brotherhood scholar. And he could say what you could or could not invest in. And one of the things that had been just released to invest in were financial institutions, banks like Barclays, and they held a large position in Barclays. And then through Barclays, they held, it appears, short positions on Lehman Brothers. So when you trace it all back, you see that on September 11th, there was a massive naked short-selling attack directed against Lehman Brothers, even though it was properly capitalized, met all the capital requirements and so forth, that literally choked all of the life out of Lehman. And when Lehman went down, the entire stock market went down. So it appears from everything we've traced that it goes right back to a decision made by a Sharia scholar sitting in Qatar who is a Muslim Brotherhood leader.
And in part, this thesis of yours has been validated by the former CEO of Lehman Brothers. You've got a terrific piece on your website, globaleconomicwarfare.com, Kevin Freeman. Tell us a bit about what this former CEO, Fuld, said that seems to bear out many of your contentions.
Well, there's no doubt, and Dick Fuld agreed with this, there's no doubt that Lehman was in a substantially acceptable position. They weren't the strongest company on Wall Street, but they were in an acceptable position. They met all the capital standards, but something triggered and happened that caused literally a run on the bank. And when that happened, within a matter of a week's time, starting on September 11th, the stock collapsed and the stock market with it. And Dick Fuld has pointed out repeatedly, we were meeting the capital standards, even far exceeding the capital standards in many cases. We weren't a bankrupt company, but somebody somewhere, and we traced it back to these sovereign wealth funds, decided to pull the trigger and say, let's do a bear raid, George Soros-style bear raid against Lehman Brothers, and they created such a panic, it collapsed Lehman, almost took down Goldman Sachs, and almost took down all of Wall Street.
Hey, Kevin, very quickly, lastly, there is a new currency in play at the moment. I want you to talk very quickly, if you could, about 1 gram. And are all of these sort of electronic and cryptocurrencies now becoming a serious threat to the sort of reserve currency status of the dollar? Or is that something still far off in the distance?
I think it's probably still pretty good in the distance, but these are the foundational elements that you would have to put in place if you were to replace the U.S. dollar. And if they're gold offered on electronic forms, ultimately backed by nation states, they have the potential to at some point replace the dollar. I don't think we're there yet. I think right now they're in their infancy, but they can grow really quickly in the right circumstances. And if sovereign wealth funds decide to adopt them, we could watch that happen, and it could happen faster than we think. But right now, I think they're in the distance.
Kevin, we have to leave it at that for the moment, though. Come back to us again next week, if you would. And in the meantime, I know you'll do continuing splendid work at globaleconomicwarfare.com. And, of course, in connection with your work as a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. Next up, we have a very special tribute on the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War from two generations of Lang fans. Witnesses to History, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is a distinct pleasure to have with us by phone two of the men that I have come to admire most. for their tenacious defense of freedom, in particular, but not exclusively, with respect to the Jewish state, Israel, and also its importance to us in America as a strategic ally and bulwark against enemies of both of our countries who wish to destroy the little Satan and the great Satan, as we've been called by some. They are Bill Langfan, an extraordinary man, born in 1922, and who has seen a tremendous amount of history and lived a fair amount of it himself, including notably in his opposition as a young man to Hitlerism and its rise and the threat that it clearly represented to the free world, and then to his service in our country's army, liberating Europe from the predations of Hitler and his Reich, including personally participating in the liberation of one of its most odious facilities, the Buchenwald death camp. He went on to become a very successful real estate magnate in New York City, a very, very profound and committed Zionist, and a leader in this country, I think, of what we are currently finding is the support for the Jewish state here on the 50th anniversary of the day in which it decisively defeated its enemies in the course of what came to be known as the Six-Day War. We also, I'm pleased to say, have his son with him, who has picked up the mantle of his real estate business, but who has also become an extraordinarily influential contributor to the public policy debate about what is at stake for us, as well as for other freedom-loving people in the state of Israel and its security. Mark Langfan is his name. He has become better known to some as the Map Man because of a brilliant insight he had many years ago that one could best understand what's going on at the moment in Israel and what might befall it, depending on what is done to the land of Israel, to specifically some of the land acquired in the course of the Six-Day War. So with all of that, and forgive me for this lengthy introduction, but I just can't say enough about Bill and Mark Langfan and how delighted I am to have us here to help us celebrate, and I really think of it as a celebration, this extraordinary 50th anniversary of Israel's victory in the Six-Day War. Gentlemen, thank you so much for taking some time to join us.
Thank you, Frank.
Bill, I'd like to start with you as this, specimen who has lived so much of this history. Talk a little bit about the years that led up to the establishment of the State of Israel and your involvement in some of their most important moments.
It really all began with me in 1938 when the powers were debating what to do with Hitler, and when Munich was created, which I debated against at age 16. I knew that making a deal with someone like Hitler was a deal with the devil and a deal that would lead to a tremendous amount of misery, which it did.
You wound up being involved, among other things, in the Battle of the Bulge after landing in Normandy and fighting your way across much of Northern Europe. Tell us a little bit about your experience in the liberation of the Buchenwald death camp.
Well, I had been hearing very, very sad stories about what allegedly was happening to the Jews in Europe in areas controlled by Hitler. And when I came upon what was going on and had been going on in Buchenwald, it just slaughtered me. I was able to talk with many of the people at Buchenwald because I had a fairly decent ability to talk Yiddish and to understand it. And I really heard the terrible, terrible things that went on there. And it really shattered my mind. And I made up my mind that I was going to do whatever possible personally to prevent something of this nature happening again.
And this, of course, was on the minds of many who didn't have your firsthand experience of the horrors of this war, and specifically the Holocaust, Bill Langfan. But it was very much a factor in the establishment of the modern state of Israel after World War II. And I just wonder, as you look back on that, to reflect, if you would, briefly, on the condition of the state of Israel, the parlous state of its security in the period prior to the 1967 Six-Day War.
What puzzled me during the negotiations prior to 67 was the fact that Israel was so split up between the so-called left and right on whether to preemptively strike or to sit back and wait for attacks from Syria through the Golan and Egypt through the Sinai. I was stunned that there could be such a division amongst people who were actually living there. It was such an obvious thing to me that to preemptively hit was the answer to hundreds of thousands of troops surrounding Israel with the verbiage that they were there and they were going to destroy Israel.
Yeah, drive the Jews into the seas. Let me bring your son, Mark Langfan, into this conversation. We're going to have to take a break here momentarily, Mark, but just quickly, give us a sense of the lay of the land at that moment. How vulnerable was Israel to the kind of, well, annihilation that the enemies surrounding it had in mind for it on the eve of the Six-Day War?
Well, the key aspect is really the difference between a standing army and a reserve army, in that Israel at that time, as well as today, really relies on its reserve army to scale up so that there's a significant order of battle that it can respond to the threat. However, with the Arabs and the Muslims, they have huge, huge standing armies. So you had small Israel with a very small standing army facing huge threats all around with huge standing armies and threatening Israel with not just being pushed into the sea, but really another genocide, another Auschwitz.
Mark, hold the thought. We're going to come right back with more with Bill and Mark Langfan on the anniversary of the Six-Day War, the conditions that led to victory for Israel and that really transformed its security posture and to the great benefit of our country as well. All of that and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of our two-part conversation with Bill Langfan and Mark Langfan, two prominent figures in the American Jewish community and leaders in American Zionism. Again, gentlemen, welcome. Mark, just again, give us a before and after, if you would, in terms of the topography of the state of Israel and why the Six-Day War made such a difference to its security?
Well, the key is you had the North and the South threats from Syria and Egypt, but you had the middle threat, which was from Jordan, which at that time controlled the mountains of Judea and the mountains of Samaria, which rise right to the west of Israel's heartland, where 70% of her population is. So what happens was Israel dealt a preemptive blow to Syria and Egypt, and Egypt, in an attempt to lure King Hussein into the war, told everybody that they were winning and destroyed Israel. So despite the fact that Israel had expressly sent a message through the UN to King Hussein that Israel was not intending to attack the West Bank, King Hussein effectively started launching artillery strikes against Israel's very population centers. Just imagine, if you will, the concentration of New York City or similar, or Brooklyn, and someone firing artillery shells into Brooklyn.
We would not stand for it, that's for sure.
A fire a simple artillery shell from a mountain right into the valley, which is, the heartland of Israel.
Which speaks to the importance, again, of this high ground. And so, in addition to the West Bank and the mountains there, you also had the Golan Heights, of course. Talk, Mark, if you would, about the physical barriers that these created to enemy action once they were in Israeli hands, and set the stage for the conversation I want to have about the idea of relinquishing them.
Exactly. The key part to the mountains is not just that they're mountains, but the purpose of the mountains for Israel's security gets back to what we talked about earlier, which is the standing army versus the reserve army. Israel needs those mountains in order to have time for Israel to have a call-up of its reserves in order to scale up its order of battle to effectively fight these huge standing armies of the Arabs and the Muslims. So if Israel were to, God forbid, relinquish those territories today, you would have a situation where enemies like Hamas or Hezbollah could fire simple Katyushas into Israel's population centers and thereby cause a huge failure of Israel's ability to mobilize.
Yeah. To say nothing of incredible loss of life among the civilian population. And Bill Langfan, you've heard these ideas for a long time, that if only Israel will relinquish the territories that it obtained, that it, well, liberated, in my way of thinking, restored to Israelis' control, that was the most important legacy of the Six-Day War, that there will be peace with the Palestinians, or peace more generally with the Arab world. I know you've been deeply skeptical of this based on the hard experience of, World War II and all of the wars that Israel has been subjected to by its enemies. Talk a little bit about this idea of land for peace, Bill, if you would.
Land for peace was the underpinning, supposedly, of Oslo. Israel was to convey control of segments on a slow basis to see whether or not the Palestinian leadership was advancing in the proper fashion. And it turned out that Israel did relinquish a very significant segment of land. And the Palestinian leadership, particularly under Arafat, had promised to have the Palestinian National Council annul the clauses in their charter calling for Israel's destruction. And they created a series of steps of deception making believe that they were in the process of changing the charter and annulling the onerous clauses of destruction of Israel. And believe it or not, they were able to deceive our then President Clinton and Netanyahu into thinking they actually did change the charter. To this day, not one word of the charter has ever been changed, and we're living today under three different formal documents by Hamas, the PLO, and Fatah, all calling for the destruction of Israel.
Yeah. So their objectives remain the same. Their ability, and this includes, of course, the people that we are told, like Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority, Fatah, the PLO, the so-called partner for peace, that if only Israel will relinquish the high ground of the West Bank. They're encouraged, of course, to give back the Golan to Syria as well, we'll see these parties actually, well, if not renounce, at least not act on their commitment to destroy the state of Israel. And Mark, let me just conclude with you. Should those lands be turned back to hostile powers, what would be the prospect for Israel's security, perhaps even its survival?
Well, in my view, the prospect is catastrophic for Israel's survival. However, what I want all your listeners to understand is this is not a question about Jewish survival. This is a question about survival of the Western world and of the United States itself. And all anyone has to do is look at a simple map on my website where you see the Middle East and you see Greece that has only 11 million Christians in Greece, and that this country is sworn to defend under NATO, and you rapidly come to a conclusion just by adding up the populations that there are 370 million Muslims to the southeast, and then you have 11 million Christians in Greece to the northwest, and the only non-Muslim country between those 370 million Muslims and the 11 million Christians of Greece that we're sworn to defend under NATO is the state of Israel. And if God forbid something happened to Israel, you wouldn't have the soft jihad today where they're bringing suitcases. You'd have a hard jihad where they would be bringing Kalashnikovs against Greece.
There's so much more to talk about than we've got time to do today, but I want to thank you both, Bill Langfan and Mark Langfan, for your insights into this incredibly important moment in history, the anniversary of the Six-Day War, and the lessons that we should learn from what preceded it and what has flowed from it. I thank you for your leadership, both of you, in helping the rest of us make sense of this, and I pray that you will keep up your good work and come back to us in the near future, and that the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.